I remember this one time when the snow began to fall and I was alone with my children at the end of that long dirt road. It snowed into the night, and when we woke up the next morning, the snow was still coming down. On the second day, the power lines got so heavy with snow, they fell down, and then there was no electricity in the house, so all we could do was pile wood in the stove and huddle close. The snowplow didn't come, and even if it had, I could never have gotten that car out. There was no thought of getting my children to school or making the 3-mile trip to town for groceries, so we ate what we had, cooked rice on the gas burners and baked potatoes in the fireplace, and when those things were used up, I made pancakes. But on the third day, even the eggs were used up, and we were all tired of playing Clue and pick-up sticks, not to mention that we were getting pretty hungry. That's when I took out my popcorn pot. It was 2 more days before the snowplow got our road clear and the power came back. In the meantime, we lived on peanut butter and popcorn at our house. And the funny thing is, I remember those as some of the best times. There was no television and no ringing phone, because that was out of service too, and nowhere to go, because there was no way of getting there. Just that pile of library books, an oil lamp, a burning fire, a few board games, and a whole lot of buttered popcorn. All this happened long ago. The daughter with whom I used to share those cozy popcorn-eating times is 34 years old now, her younger brothers 30 and 28. All die-hard popcorn poppers today and staunch opponents of microwave popcorn or any other methods that deviate from our old standby of the pot, the oil, the flame. I don't get many chances anymore to make popcorn for my children, but I will add here, as a person who now spends a significant amount of time every year in Central America, that I have adapted one aspect of my cold-weather ritual of popcorn making. At the house I go to every winter in Guatemala, cold weather never comes, but children do, and when they show up at my door, looking to borrow my soccer ball or swim off the dock at my house, and I see them hungry, as they nearly always are, there is one food I always make for them. In Guatemala, the country where popcorn is said to have originated, the Spanish word for it is poporopo. No meaning there. Onomatopoeia, I think. But my favorite word for my favorite food comes from Mexico, where they call it palomitas. Translation, little white doves. So here I stand, a woman with a world of fancy kitchen gadgets and gourmet ingredients in my kitchen, a Viking range and a shelf full of cookbooks offering up recipes, and I'm still popping popcorn in my old and dented pot. Except for the butter I drizzle over it, the popcorn I eat today is no different from what those Mayan or Inca or Aztec people ate 1,000 years ago, and the stuff first served up from those steam-driven popcorn wagons or hawked on the street during America's Great Depression when nobody could afford candy. I have never gotten over loving the sound of corn popping. I love the sense I have making popcorn that I am connected with hundreds of generations of people who performed some variation on this same corn popping ritual. Hearing that sound, it never fails to strike me that a nearly miraculous transformation is taking place in this pot of mine. How can it be that a couple of handfuls of hard little kernels tossed in a pot and placed over a fire will transform themselves into a fluffy white mountain, expanding to the point where they push the lid right off the pot? There are simple enough scientific explanations for this, of course. But to me, it always feels more like magic.
That was journalist and novelist Joyce Maynard with tonight's essay. Tomorrow night at the same time, Michael Cunningham, best known for his novel The Hours, explains why macaroni and cheese in a box was a meal which suggested to him a fabulous futuristic world. That's tomorrow night at 10:45. And just to add, you can catch up online on the Radio 3 website. This week's essay series is a Corporation for Independent Media Production for BBC Radio 3. And now on Radio 3, a little later than scheduled, for which my apologies, tonight's Late Junction with Fiona Talkington. And music first from the Danish ukulele-based duo L. Offenfanberg. Thank you.
The duo there of Asmus Titjens and Dieter Merbius, who first recorded together in a bigger project in 1976, and they promised each other then that they'd make an album, just the two of them. Well, it only took 35 years, these two masters of electronic music finally getting into the studio together last year. I've got more for you from Merbius throughout the week in some of his other projects. And before them, a more youthful duo from Denmark, Nikolaj Vamberg playing bass and Tobias Elof on ukulele, with their version of a traditional Halling dance tune from their duo album. Yodeling, both solo and in duet, next from the Babayak Pygmies of Gabon, recorded in 1966. And I'm going to follow them with a piece by the German composer Gerhard Stäbler, which he wrote in 1986. It's called Warning with Love Song for harp, accordion and percussion, using chromatically tuned bottles, whistling and some really beautiful harp writing. The foreword in the score quotes Christa Wolf. It is possible to know the start of wartime, but when does the pre-war period begin? Hey, Gerhard Stäbler's 1986 piece Warnung mit Liebeslied, Warning with Love Song, for harp, accordion and percussion, played there by Karin Schmeer, Theodor Anzalotti and Rainer Römer. A beautiful piece, I think, that Stäbler wrote just after he'd won the Cornelius Cardew Memorial Prize. And that followed yodeling voices from Gabon from the Babayak people, recorded in 1966. I'm Fiona Talkington. You're listening to Late Junction on BBC Radio 3.
Les amants de Paris couchent sur ma chanson. À Paris, les amants s'aiment à leur façon. Les refrains que je leur dis, c'est plus beau que les beaux jours. Ça fait des tas de printemps et le printemps fait l'amour. Mon couplet s'est perdu sur les bords d'un jardin. On me l'a jamais rendu et pourtant je sais bien. Les amants de Paris m'ont volé mes chansons. À Paris, les amants ont de drôles de façons. Les amants de Paris se font à Robinson. Quand on marque des points à coups d'accordéon, les amants de Paris vont changer de saison. En traînant par la main mon petit brin de chanson. Il y a plein d'or, plein de lilas et des yeux pour les voir. D'habitude c'est comme ça que commencent les histoires. Les amants de Paris se font à Robinson. À Paris, les amants de drôles de passion. J'ai la chaîne d'amour au bout de mes deux mains. Il y a des millions d'amants et je n'ai qu'un refrain. On y voit tout autour les gars du monde entier. Qui donnerait bien le printemps pour venir s'aligner. Pour eux, c'est pas beaucoup corde pour moi de même. J'en ai collé partout dans leur calendrier. Les amants de Paris ont usé mes chansons. À Paris, les amants s'aiment à leur façon. Donnez-moi des chansons pour qu'on s'aime à Paris.
Now we're all smiling. The one and only Edith Piaf and Les Amants de Paris, the lovers of Paris. As I mentioned earlier on, I've been listening to pieces with unusual tunings this week. One of my favourite pieces which does this is Stephen Mackie's 1996 piece Myrtle and Mint, in which he plays guitar using a microtonal tuning, and he's also the storyteller using fragments of Hans Christian Andersen. Steve Mackie teaches composition at Princeton University. He describes himself as playing in rock bands when he was young, gave up the glamorous life as a rock musician to become a freestyle skier, gave up the glamorous life as a freestyle skier to play the lute, gave up the lute and work as director of an early music ensemble to become a serious composer. So here's the story of Myrtle and Mint.
Well then, let's begin. And when we come to the end of the story, we'll know more than we do now. are far away from here, where the swallows fly when we have winter. Far out to sea, where the water is as blue as the prettiest cornflower and as clear as the purest glass. In China, where, as you know, the emperor is a Chinaman, and all those he has around him are Chinese as well. Still, when the great bell in the old clock tower struck midnight. It happened over 100 years ago. It happened many years ago by now. And for that reason, the story is worth listening to at least one more time before it is forgotten. Once upon a time, there were once 25 tin soldiers. 5, 10, 15, 20, 25. They were all brothers, for they were all born from the same old tin spoon. There was once a little girl who was very pretty and very dainty, but alas, she was very poor. There was once an old witch who was so ugly. She was so ugly that her bottom lip hung all the way down to her breasts. She had two of them. In time, they came to the warm lands, where the sun shone much more brightly than it does here. Oranges and lemons hung in woods scented with myrtle and mint. And all along country lanes, lovely children ran and played with great, brightly colored butterflies. Life was good, until one day, music began. Big black grasshoppers played the juice harp, and the owl beat on his belly as though it were a drum. It was a strange concert. Single peal that lasted the whole night through. The window flew open, and the evil princess flew. She laughed at the storm, as though it were not enough for her. Said the soldier. Either you tell me right now what you want with it, or I'll draw my sword and hack off your head.
No, I won't!
So we cut off her head, and there she lay. He tied up all his money in her apron, heaved the bundle over his back, and marched straight into town. It was a fine town, and he took himself to the finest inn. He booked himself the very best rooms and ordered all the things he liked best in the world to eat. For he was rich now, with all that money. Ill-gotten money, if you ask me. Gerda was very sad. She'd been waiting for her brother's return for many months now, and had nearly lost all hope. Their treehouse was cold and lonely, not at all the cozy place it was when Hans was there with her. Even the music box he made for her seemed to play its tune in a sadder key no matter how often she wound it. Autumn was nearly past. The swallows had long since flown to the warm lands. It saddened her to leave now. What if Hans should return tomorrow? But she knew that their mother would need her all the more, with Hans missing. So she packed her things, taking special care with the music box, and began the long journey home. Princess gazed with wonder at the cool, crisp dawn that rose over her father's kingdom. Even the gallows erected to hang her beloved seemed to glow in the pastel light. Her father and mother, the king and queen, were proudly seated at their thrones opposite the judge and his council. The soldier had already mounted the ladder, and they were about to fasten the rope around his neck, when he said, "Excuse me, but a condemned man is always granted a final, harmless request before he undergoes his punishment. I would dearly love to smoke a pipe of tobacco. It would be my last in this world." Well, the king could not say no to that. So the soldier took his tinderbox and struck a light. One,
3. There stood all the dogs. The one with eyes as round as teacups. The one with eyes like millstones. And the one with eyes as big as the round tower of Copenhagen. Now help me, cried the soldier, so that I shan't be hanged. Dogs pounced on the king and queen, took one by the nose and one by the legs, and flung them many fathoms into the air. When they fell to the ground, they were smashed to pieces. And the people cried, "Little soldier, you shall be our king, and have our lovely princess as your bride."
I never tire of hearing that. Stephen Mackie's Myrtle and Mint. Steve himself playing microtonal guitar and telling the story based on fragments by Hans Christian Andersen. And if you like it as much as I do and you want to track it down, you'll find it on an album called Lost and Found. And as usual, you can find details of the music in Late Junction this week in the Late Junction playlists, and you can find those on the Radio 3 website. The Irish singer Heidi Talbot has a new album out. This is a rather lovely song written with her husband, the fiddle player John McCusker, who also produced the album. Will I Ever Get to Sleep?
An old one lives next door.
Heidi Talbot and Will I Ever Get to Sleep, which comes from her new EP, My Sister the Moon. Heidi's next concert is in Sheffield, a cathedral, no less, on the 1st of December, and then the next day at the Great British Folk Festival in Skegness. And if you look at her website, she's got lots of dates going through February and March next year. Fragments of Romanian folk music find their way into Michael Nyman's String Quartet No. 3. Here's the slow movement played by the Balanescu Quartet.
Thank you. Trompetista. Armonica. Contrabajo.
A luxury, a pleasure to waste time, an excess of emotion without rules, a fantastic tra-la-la without meaning and practical use. Now everybody, let's dance.
Deladub Move Lesson 1. Put your hands over your head. Enjoy the rhythm. Right now. Lesson 2. Clap your hands energetic to the rhythm. Right now. Lesson 3. Jump to the air. Right now. We'll be right back. lesson four. Shake your feet to the beat right now. Lesson five. Shout hop now. The last lesson six. Just sing together.
It's a band from Vienna called Deladap with a track called Georgian Lessons Numbers 1 to 6. And that features on Robert Sucko's Balkan Beat Sound Lab album, which is just out. The great Hungarian singer Bea Polya, just before, an album from 9 years ago now. She's such a fine singer. And I do wish she was over here in the UK more often. And first of all, there's the slow movement from Michael Nyman's String Quartet No. 3, played by the Balanescu Quartet. Admir Shkurtaj is a pianist and composer, and he comes from Albania, but he's been living in the Salento region of Italy for over 20 years, and he's become inspired by the infectious pizzica music of the region, often clothing traditional melodies in a rather heavy disguise. Thank you.
Pas de change avec Marie dans mon doigt. Moi pas prier personne mon nom. La guerre loi ça pour moi. Yeah yeah. Pas de change avec Marie dans mon doigt. Moi pas prier personne mon nom. La guerre loi ça pour moi. Je m'en gagne bien. Je m'en gagne malin dans nos. C'est Jaco. Bayo la vie pour moi. Je m'en gagne bien. Marie dans mon dos, non pas prier personne, la guerre joie ça pour moi. Toi tu Jacques Marie dans mon dos, moi pas prier personne mon dos, la guerre joie ça pour moi. Et malgré les pions, et malgré les malins dans nous, c'est Jaco, paye la vie pour moi. Et malgré les pions, pions.
from Haiti, Ti Coca and his band Wanga Neige, who've been together for 36 years, following in the tradition of the Bal Creole troubadours. Toile Saint-Jacques was the title of that song, following on from Admir Shkurtai's arrangement of an Italian pizzica tune from Salento. Lamont Young considers his epic composition, the well-tuned piano, to be his masterpiece. He wrote it in 1964, and he managed to keep the tuning a closely guarded secret for nearly 30 years. Performances of it have lasted as long as 6 hours, so just an extract to end Late Junction tonight. Hope you can join me at the same time tomorrow. Till then, good night. Thank you.
Hello from me, Nicola Hall, and welcome to Through the Night on Radio 3. The next couple of hours feature chamber music from Warsaw, the venue, the Grand Hall in the Royal Castle. The occasion was the 16th Beethoven Easter Festival in April 2012. The programme of music includes the suite from The Soldier's Tale by Stravinsky, the String Quartet No. 8 by Shostakovich, and Messiaen's Quartet for the End of Time. But the concert starts with the Cello Sonata in D by Beethoven, the last of his five cello sonatas. It dates from 1815, when he'd just become guardian to his nephew Carl, and a time when most of his creative energy was going into writing songs. It's played by Arto Norris and Joram Sonn.